It's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. Dialogue Conspiracy number 200, exactly 200, June 9th, 1975. I've been on this program for 4 years. There were 8 weeks that we took vacation, a few Christmases, I believe three Christmases. I took 3 weeks off because there was a lot of advertising on the station and the station needed the time. And last year they were generous enough to allow the show to continue without interruption because there are other stations that are listening and the show has become syndicated and they wouldn't take a station break back there necessarily. So this is number 200 in Dialogue Conspiracy, June the 9th, 1975. I do hope that as many people as possible can get their tape cassette machines or reels and make copies of these programs, because for the next 10 weeks I'm going to try to give the bulk of the program to Gerald Ford's book, The Portrait of the Assassin. CBS is going to do a televised show, MGM is making, of Gerald Ford's book on the deranged Oswald. And I feel it's imperative to take this time to discuss that book and analyze it with you and give you my interpretation after 11 years of research of where Gerald Ford is coming from. If you can't make tapes of these shows, you can order four at a time or more by sending 550. They're 550 a program, a minimum of four programs for the large reels, or you can buy cassettes for $3.60. And I hope that people that listen make copies of the cassettes. You can order them here at KLRB, Carmel, California, Carmel, Brussel. And I hope you make copies and send them to members of the House Select Committee on Intelligence that will be going into the matter of assassinations and conspiracies shortly. You can send them to Ronald Dulles, Michael Harrington, Robert Kastenmeier, Don Edwards. Send copies of these shows to them, hopefully one each week if you have the money or the interest, and send letters to members of the Senate, the committee, Senator Church's committee, until it folds up about the information you have here, and hopefully send messages to the White House and also to CBS and MGM and tell them about this book that is being dissected on the air, and try to follow each week the interpretation I give to sections of this book that is an atrocious lie compiled by a member of the House of Representatives who I believe actually is the same ilk as Richard Nixon from Navy Intelligence, who perpetuates and continues to perpetuate the lie that Lee Harvey Oswald was deranged, much less the assassin, when he never owned a rifle or shot a rifle in Dealey Plaza. As I say, the bulk of the programs is going to be on Gerald Ford's book and Lee Harvey Oswald. I just, before I get into it, want to make a few statements that I'll be picking up later on various programs. One is that Senator Jackson's committee is beginning investigations on drug corruption charges. This is just starting today, and that's another area that is linked to political assassinations, which, when I say CIA, go into the Drug Administration, Internal Revenue, and the Hughes Corporation. And the hearings today that are opening up in Washington, D.C., have to do with murder, kidnappings, planted evidence, using of illegal wiretaps, stolen federal payrolls for informers. This is from a United Press article today. Hearings on drug corruption charges that the narcotics agents are accused of murdering, kidnapping, planting evidence, illegal wiretaps, and huge payments for informants. It's going into the Howard Hughes Summa Corporation that took over Las Vegas gaming tables. It was called Operation Silver Dollar, and according to my research, I've said that Hughes has not been seen in 20 years. I know Hughes wasn't in Vegas, but this was the beginning of squeezing out the Italian Jewish mafia and taking it to the bigger league of the Central Intelligence Agency and their narcotic traffic all over the world. The investigation is supposed to go into the funding of Drug Enforcement Administration, which used to pay informers $500,000 but had a budget last year of $9.6 million. It went from 1969 to $500,000 for informers up to $9.6 million. And they're going to investigate this and then the murdering of the informants to keep the pockets in the hands of the police and the Drug Administration after they've used these informants. This is a huge investigation. We have Watergate in the past 3 years. It's the anniversary of Watergate next week. We have Watergate West, which is the criminal justice department in California, the Los Angeles police, the San Francisco police, the political assassinations and massacres. That story has yet to open up. And I guess the drug enforcement and the struggle between the U's and the mafia money centering in Vegas, the kidnapping, the murdering is another Watergate, a third branch of the Watergate that is a part of these general conspiracies and assassinations. I do want to say a lot about Popeye Jackson. He was slain last night. Popeye Jackson was head of the Prisoners Union in California. I was at Popeye's home about 2 months ago. Realized he was being set up. We had a similar plan almost set up in my own home just about 10 days ago, which was very threatening. I could see what was happening to this particular person, Popeye, with these groupies around him, that he's being infiltrated and being set up for a kill. And I would like to do a program on Popeye, but I'm going to pass this up and go mostly to the Gerald Ford book. We also see that Russell Means was shot, almost killed, wounded in the abdomen by a police officer, a police lieutenant. Means was arrested, federal charges in connection with wounded knee occupation, and the case was dismissed, but Russell Means was shot by a policeman last night. Mr. Camille, another defendant in a lengthy trial, the Gainesville trial down in Florida, was acquitted on those charges. The government had trumped up allegedly planning violence for the conventions in Miami, and Mr. Camille was acquitted in that case, and he was shot and almost murdered about a week and a half ago. And so it goes. Popeye is dead. Russell Means is alive. The assassination teams work out of many fronts. When you say CIA, that includes Navy intelligence, the Drug Assistance Bureau. The government has many assassination teams that are covered and funded, and that's why they need these huge funds, like $9 million a year for their informers. But I do want to go into The Portrait of the Assassin, which is a very important book, and talk about Gerald Ford. There's a new book out by Theodore White on Richard Nixon. It's called The Breach of Faith, and it's about Richard Nixon. And Theodore White asks why President Nixon had such a large groundswell at the election and then went into such trivia as a Watergate break-in. And he should have admitted what he did, such as the Bay of Pigs fiasco, and John Kennedy admitted that error. And White says few heads would have rolled and it all would have been forgotten. But his analysis that Richard Nixon is just too proud and the cover-up is what snowballed. But Theodore White is not a good historian. I've read his books on the making of the presidents, and he covers up as much as he tells us. And my feeling is that Richard Nixon couldn't confess, because immediately after the Watergate arrest, Richard Nixon's problem was that it would go back to the Bay of Pigs, and E. Howard Hunt wanted $1 million for things that he had done for the White House, and Richard Nixon said, Helms has to cover us, we've done favors for him. And I think it all goes back to November 22nd, 1963, when this team, including Gerald Ford, all were a part of a cover-up of killing the President of the United States, and Richard Nixon was caught in the work he had done earlier with Frank Sturgis and E. Howard Hunt and the Watergate team that were caught. Several people caught the Watergate were involved in the Bay of Pigs when Richard Nixon was behind that. And Theodore White blames Richard Nixon. He says in his book, he says that Richard Nixon destroyed the presidential myth that has sustained this nation through two centuries. The myth that presidents will faithfully execute the laws of the land. The result has shaken the nation, but has not, one hopes, weakened its trust in government system. And I am saying right now that Richard Nixon did not destroy the presidential myth any more than Lyndon Johnson or Gerald Ford. That the president executes the law of the land faithfully, only when he executes the law of the land faithfully. Lyndon Johnson destroyed it. A play on Broadway a few years back when he was still president named McBird illustrated dramatically at the time Johnson was president the role he had in the Kennedy assassination. And so out of the Kennedy assassination, there are rumors and speculations about John Kennedy's murder, Martin Luther King's murder, Robert Kennedy's murder, Malcolm X's murder, the killing of Mary Jo Kopechne at Chappaquiddick, the shooting of Wallace. And it started before Richard Nixon. Lyndon Johnson appointed the Warren Commission. Richard Nixon appointed Gerald Ford on the Warren Commission. And the covering up goes on. And Gerald Ford is a large part of the cover up of the century. And that's why he's president. And Theodore White picks on Richard Nixon, conveniently, when Gerald Ford is in the ball game now. July 24th, 1964, there was a letter sent by courier service by hand. I guess it was too precious to send in the ordinary mail. And it was from J. Edgar Hoover. And it was mailed to Honorable J. Lee Rankin, the general counsel for the President's Commission investigating the assassination of John Kennedy. J. Edgar Hoover wrote that Mr. James Thompson, the editor of Life magazine, was in contact with Representative Gerald Ford. He, Representative Ford, commented to Mr. Thompson that he was preparing a book regarding Lee Harvey Oswald and the assassination that is not going to be released until after the public release of the report by the President's Commission. July 24, 1964, Gerald Ford, working with the Warren Commission, was already preparing a book about Lee Harvey Oswald, the person who he claims was the assassin of John Kennedy, but who actually did not assassinate John Kennedy. In this same letter, there was a question about an issue of Life magazine that came out, and the Dallas Morning News, June 27th and June 28th, 1964, carried a story about a diary that Lee Harvey Oswald wrote. And this is important to the book of Gerald Ford, because Gerald Ford uses this diary of Oswald's to lean on in his book. Several chapters of his, chapter 3 and 5, are all quotations from Oswald's diary. And the Dallas Morning News broke the story of this diary June 27th and 28th. Now, Lee Harvey Oswald had been dead since November 24th, 1963. So 6 months later, the Dallas Morning News comes out with excerpts from a diary of Lee Harvey Oswald. And Life magazine the next week, July the 10th, had excerpts of the diary of Lee Harvey Oswald, and it has a picture of Oswald and his wife, Marina, on the cover with the diary. Mr. John F. Dowd, the general counsel for Life magazine, was advised that the last part of June in 1964 and a month earlier, a Mr. James Thompson, the editor of Life, visited Gerald Ford in Washington, D.C. And during their visit, they had contact with Ford and they had dinner with him. And several weeks previous to this, Warren Commission member Gerald Ford was in New York City and made a social visit to Life magazine. Life magazine, run by Henry Luce, has been a deciding instrument in the Cold War for many years in this country. And Luce's role politically was as powerful as Allen Dulles or John Foster Dulles, his visual lifetime and fortune, his magazines, have played a very important part in many of these assassinations and to keep the story going, perpetuate the cover story while not doing investigative work to the discrepancies in the physical evidence, much less the witness testimony. Well, Gerald Ford and Mr. Thompson had contact in Washington, D.C., and Ford revealed at the time he was writing the book on Oswald. And then the leaks came out about this diary, and the question came, where did this diary come from? The leaks were attributed to Gerald Ford, then congressman, who at the same time revealed he was going to write a book on Oswald. But where did the diary appear? Because it was so much a part of Gerald Ford's book, I want to briefly mention Gerald Ford relies upon it in his book. Chapter 3 is called Romance in Minsk. Chapter 5 is Another Side of Lee Harvey Oswald. And in addition to those two chapters, the book is just riddled with reference for this diary. And again, you may get Life magazine and look it up July the 10th, 1964. If you don't have Life magazine, and if you're in a library that has the 26 volumes of the hearings before the President's Commission on the Assassination of John Kennedy. The diary is printed in volume 16, page 94, pages 94 to 122, and their commission exhibits numbered 24 and 25. The volumes of the testimony in the 26 volumes, there were 552 witnesses called before the Warren Commission or the staff. 15 volumes were a witness testimony of these 552 witnesses. The last 10 volumes are 1,000 pages each, 10,000 pages. Nowhere in the Warren Report is there a inventory of any police finding the diary of Lee Harvey Oswald. They found a lot of other things, parts of cameras and radios and personal belongings, inventories in the garage of Mrs. Ruth Payne, where Marine Oswald lived, inventories of his possessions at a rooming house on Beckley Street, what was in Lee Harvey Oswald's pockets when he was arrested, what his family had seen, but no police report in the 26 volumes of anybody finding this diary that Gerald Ford was to leak. There's only a few brief mentions of the diary in the book at all, and Marina Oswald, the wife of Lee Harvey Oswald, was on the stand, and I'll tell you what she had to say about this diary. I'm going into this diary because I think that the Church Committee in the House of Representatives should find out if this diary does in fact exist. No original hand copy has been produced to anybody, and I wanted to know whose fingerprints were on there, who wrote that diary, because Gerald Ford has used it, and yet it hardly exists. Mr. Rankin, I'm going to read you some of the testimony from Volume 1 about Marina Oswald's questioning on this diary. Now, she's the first witness is called before the Warren Commission, and this is in January, and it's in July or June that the diary breaks the news in Dallas, and it breaks the news in Life, and Gerald Ford is in contact with Life magazine in Washington and New York, but this is the only mention of Marina Oswald's testimony and a few other sentences in the witness testimony that have to do with this. Mr. Rankin said, "Do you know any reason why your husband was permitted to stay in the Soviet Union when he first came?" Mrs. Oswald, "I don't know." "You don't know why?" Mrs. Oswald, "Many were surprised at that here in Russia." Mr. Rankin, "Did your husband do any writing while he was in the Soviet Union that you know of?" Now, this is page 99, volume 1. Mrs. Oswald, "Yes, he wrote a diary about his stay in the Soviet Union." Mr. Rankin, "I handed you Exhibit 24 and ask you if this is a photostatic copy of the diary that you have referred to." Now, this is interesting because why isn't it the original diary? Why the photostatic? Where does the original diary belong? Who has it? This is an important question. He said, "I hand you Exhibit 24. Is this the photostatic copy?" "Yes, that's Lee's handwriting. It's a pity I don't understand it. It seems to me there was more." Mr. Rankin, "Mrs. Oswald, this is all of the historic diary that we have received. There are some other materials that I will call your attention to. Apparently, they are not part of that." The Warren Commission received part of the diary. Was there more? Where does it exist? She's never seen it. It's a photostat. Earl Warren, chairman, says, "It may be admitted. Take the next number." The document was marked Commission Exhibit 24. Mr. Rankin, "It's not all that he ever wrote, but it is all that apparently fits together as part of the descriptive diary." And they say, "Sometimes," she answers, "sometimes he wrote two or three days in a row." They ask her, how was it made? "Sometimes he wrote two or three days in a row. Sometimes he wouldn't write at all." Earl Warren said, "Mrs. Oswald, you said a few minutes ago it was a pity you couldn't read this. Would you like to have the interpreter read it so that you'll know what's in it? You may if you wish." In other words, "Do you want to read what your husband wrote?" She hadn't read it before. She pretended she didn't know English, which she knew very well. And this can be verified by many people and witnesses. And here's a diary, a photostat, that she's never read or seen to verify any of the ideas of the information. And they said, "Would you like to read it sometime?" And Earl Warren says, "You may read it anytime you wish." Mr. Rankin, "Mrs. Oswald has raised a question about whether this was complete. And this was all that was given to us as Exhibit 24, but we'll check back to see if they've overlooked, if the FBI has it, and if they gave it to us." Mrs. Oswald, your husband apparently made another diary that he wrote in the Holland American line. Are you familiar with that? And she says, no. I'll give you Exhibit 25 and ask if you recall seeing that. She says, I know the paper, but I don't know what was contained in this. I didn't know this was a diary. Do you know what it was? No, I don't know it was. I don't even know when he wrote this or whether this paper was aboard the ship when we came to the United States. I only know the paper and the handwriting. Do you know if it's your husband's handwriting? Yes. Now, later, the diary was fingerprinted. And I'll read you the evidence on the diary and the fingerprinting, because this historic diary was presented to Marina Oswald, who really didn't even recognize it. And it's an interesting point when you read the diary. If you get the Time, the Life magazine, or you look up in Volume 16, Exhibit 24, the diary, there isn't any other letter or word or message, series of messages, pertaining to Lee Harvey Oswald in the Warren Commission hearings, Volume 16 to 26. Those are 10 volumes, 10,000 pages, that resembles Commission Exhibit 24 and 25, that those exhibits are totally misspelled. They're nothing like Oswald's writing, but every other exhibit in there, letters to the Navy, letters asking for discharge, letters to his family when he was in Soviet Union, job applications, language skills, letters from New Orleans to people in the Soviet Union. There's all kinds of letters in these 10,000 pages of Lee Harvey Oswald, and nothing at all resembles the diary that Gerald Ford is going to use in his book as the backbone. And not only that, but his wife has never seen this or recognized this or read it or can really say that it pertains to factual evidence in his life in the Soviet Union. She hasn't read it. Now, the way the Warren Commission handled this is, I'll read you a copy of a memorandum which I received from the National Archives, dated July 21st, 1964, and it was written by Mr. Alfred Goldberg, who was the historian, one of two historians, sent to write the Warren Report from the Air Force. He was a military Pentagon man, and he wrote a letter to Mr. Rankin, and he's writing a section in the Warren Report called Allegations, Theories, and Rumors. And he writes to the chief counsel, the gentleman from the Air Force, and he said, I've collected between 125 and 150 allegations that should probably be answered in this appendix. Included in this list are allegations which we do not appear to have the answer, but which may require further investigation of the FBI. And under list of allegations, one of them is there's a rifle cartridge recovered by the railroad overpass. An allegation saying that Oswald never had a gun in his room by the rooming house lady. But allegation number 8 is this. It says, some of Oswald's letters were well written and much superior to his usual style. These letters were probably written by someone other than Oswald himself. So what they're saying is that out of 10,000 pages, page after page of well-written letters and documents of Oswald, where he's alone in Russia or alone in Texas. Oh, I got a kiss from Chuck here. Where Oswald is doing his business, writing for applications to come home to the United States, writing the State Department. The historian from the Pentagon covers this by saying that these letters were written by someone other than Oswald himself. And they're trying to make the opinion that Oswald, through Commission Exhibit 24 and 25, which are just a few pages of this huge, massive amount of 26 volumes, that those pages of Oswald where he allegedly tries to commit suicide, where he has emotional problems, where he can't spell, where he sounds deranged, the part that Gerald Ford's going to use in his book, the historian from the Pentagon would make you think that those 5 or 10 pages are the normal Oswald, and that the 10,000 pages of documents sprinkled with massive amount of letters from Oswald are written by somebody other than Oswald, which would be totally impossible because nobody else was writing these letters in New Orleans or in the Marines, applying for discharge and so forth, and his high aptitude test at the employment agency, his college applications. The way the Warren Commission fits all their evidence into Oswald being the lone assassin, the deranged assassin, that historian Gerald Ford can write about is by saying that his letters were written by somebody else, implying that the diary is the official version. Well, the Warren Report, Chapter 6, has the section on conspiracy. And they refer to this diary again. And this diary again, it had to be fingerprinted and it had to be identified by the FBI. And I'll read you some information about just how they went about that with this great diary. But volume chapter 6 of the Warren Report, which is a summary of what the 26 volumes put together, said Oswald's historic diary commences October the 16th, 1959, the day Oswald arrived in Moscow. And other writings he prepared provided the commission with one source of information about Oswald's activities. Even assuming the diary was intended to be a truthful record, is not an accurate guide to the details of Oswald's life. Oswald seems not to have been concerned about the accuracy of the dates and names, and apparently made many of his entries subsequent to the date the events occurred. Now, couldn't it be that somebody else was writing, like Arthur Bremer's diary or Sirhan Sirhan's diary, that somebody, even an E. Howard Hunt, who was known to the White House and the White House tapes as the writer, who was working for Alan Dulles at the time of the killing of John Kennedy, isn't it possible that somebody else was writing this diary? It hasn't been produced. It hasn't been identified as being Lee Harvey Oswald's at all. The Warren Report even admits that this diary was off on dates and off on entries. It says, in addition, the writings have been checked for consistency of style, grammar, and spelling with earlier, later writings that are known to be his, and no indication has been found that entries were written or coached by another person. Now, this Warren Report, page 258, 259, is a total lie. The consistency, the grammar, the spelling is totally out of contact with everything that Lee Harvey Oswald has written, except for some things that may be in the possession of his mother, Marguerite Oswald. I have read many books on Lee Harvey Oswald. I have 109 books on the Kennedy assassination, investigative work. I have read the Warren Commission hearings, the 26 volumes, the Warren Report, read as much as I could that Lee Harvey Oswald wrote, and the diary is totally inconsistent with anything that Lee Harvey Oswald ever wrote in style, grammar, spelling, and furthermore, the diary wasn't produced until Gerald Ford was meeting with Life magazine. And even Marina Oswald didn't know where the diary was. And to this day, they can't explain how that diary was produced. And I go into this as we get to Gerald Ford's book and begin to analyze it, because it's important to see that Gerald Ford was using a piece of junk that was planted and forged. I have documents showing that the FBI planted and forged during the COINTELP program. They've admitted that they've done a lot of this. You see these hearings coming up with the Drug Administration of this kind of thing. And I believe that this diary was planted and forged, and a member of the House of Representatives who became the President of the United States perpetuates a book that is being made by CBS filled with untruths. Now, in July 27, 1964, another letter, this one, a courier service, sent. A lot of people didn't trust the ordinary mail. This was from J. Edgar Hoover, and he is asking about the diary that was produced on the cover of Life magazine just that same week. He wrote this letter July 27th to the chief investigator of the Warren Commission, Mr. Honorable J. Lee Rankin. And he said, "Dear Mr. Rankin, reference is made in your letter dated June 30th and July 10th asking that an investigation be conducted to determine the circumstances surrounding obtaining and publishing the excerpts of Lee Harvey Oswald's historic diary in the Dallas Morning News and Life magazine." Now, this is Mr. Rankin from the Warren Commission asking J. Edgar Hoover, who worked with Gerald Ford and the Warren Commission, what are the circumstances of this diary that appeared in Life? Hoover said, "The Dallas office of the FBI furnished the FBI laboratory the following items obtained from Henry Wade, the district attorney of Dallas, Texas, and which he advised are material his office had concerning the diary and other evidence. There's one roll of 35 millimeter positive film, one roll of 35 millimeter negative film, and 15 Xerox prints of some of the pages of Oswald's diary. Some of the pages. Where are the others, you see? Okay, Hoover says the New York office of this bureau has obtained and furnished to the laboratory copies of Oswald's diary that were purchased and published by Life magazine. Now, Life magazine purchased the Abraham Zapruder film that was locked up for many years and is just open to the American public now, thanks to people who got a hold of the original copy and are showing it around the country. And Life magazine somehow purchased a diary, but we don't know who they purchased it from. Where did they get it? Marina Oswald only heard about it when it broke in the Dallas newspaper, and she said she didn't mind receiving a sum. I think it was $20,000, but she didn't know where they got this diary. Now, J. Edgar Hoover writes, this is some more to Mr. Rankin, that Life purchased this diary of Oswald's. He said examination of these items in the FBI has established that the 35mm positive film obtained from the Dallas District Attorney's Office had imperfections in the original state that are reproduced in the 35mm negative obtained from the District Attorney's Office. In addition, these imperfections from the positive, plus some original imperfections in the negative film, are all reproduced in the Xerox prints of this film that was obtained. It says, this shows that Life magazine copies were originated from the Dallas District Attorney's Office. Investigation regarding the film in the possession of the DA's office established that shortly after the assassination, the material, including the diary, which the Dallas Police Department obtained from the various residences of Oswald, was furnished to the FBI in Dallas, where it was photographed on film and for recorded purpose. A copy of the film was given to the Dallas Police Department. Now, parts of this diary were furnished, and it's from the various residences. We'll go that into a minute. And then it was photographed. You see, keep in mind that the original is not in the hands of anybody, and we should ask Frank Church and the House Committee investigating these matters for the original of Lee Harvey Oswald's diary to see if it connects the Dallas to the Watergate persons, because I have reason to believe it is a good lead. J. Edgar Hoover said representatives from the Dallas District Attorney's Office subsequently requested copies of the material from the police department. The Xerox copy of the diary obtained from the DA's office and the Xerox copies obtained from Life magazine were examined for latent fingerprints. Now, this is interesting. They did fingerprints for the Xerox copies, but not fingerprints on the original diary. And Gerald Ford uses this as the backbone of his book. Let's find out if Oswald even touched the diary. They took latent fingerprints and palm prints from the Xerox copies, and what did they find? They found that 5 latent fingerprints and 4 latent palm prints were developed on Life's copies of the Xerox prints, and they were from the District Attorney's Office in Dallas, Texas. And one of the latent fingerprints of the copies is identical with the left thumbprint of F. William Franklin Alexander, who may be identical with William F. Alexander, the Assistant District Attorney in Dallas, Texas. And the other fingerprints and palm prints have not been identified. Now, this is from J. Edgar Hoover. The Warren Commission counsel asked him about the circumstances of the diary, and this is the letter the FBI writes. So what they're saying is that shortly after the assassination, the diary material, including the diary, was obtained by the Dallas Police Department from the various residences of Oswald. Now, Marina Oswald never saw the diary before. She didn't even know when it came out that he had a diary. Which residences was it at? Did he keep some at Beckley Street? Did he keep some at Irving, Texas? Was one diary in 2 residences? I doubt it. But the police report says it was from residences of Oswald. Did they piece it together, or was this planted? Remember when Charles Colson from the White House called E. Howard Hunt and said to get to Arthur Bremer's apartment all the way from Maryland to Milwaukee before the FBI gets there? Or Marilyn Baker got into the SLA house after the fire at Concord, and it was 24 hours before the police closed off the house, how Sirhan Sirhan's diary was taken from his house without a search warrant, and Sirhan didn't write that diary. Which residences was this diary taken from? Which police officers? Now, these officers have to have names. We have a diary that's the cover of Life magazine, We have a president of the United States who wrote a book using this diary as the background of his book. 11 years later, we have CBS making a 4 to 6 hour movie using this diary, and Lee Harvey Oswald's profile based on this diary. And Gerald Ford said he wants to set the history straight for America. So whenever these cyclical conspiratorial things come up, they can keep producing his version. So let us find out. And as I said, I hope you're taping this and taping notes. Write to these various committees, to CBS, and say which residences were these diaries taken from that Lee Harvey Oswald had. Which police officers by name found these diaries, or this diary if it's two residences? What date was it found? When? Because Oswald's picture with the head superimposed on the body, while he was still arrested and alive, he said was superimposed. Why wouldn't it make the headlines if a diary of the Soviet Union, of his attempted suicide, his job in Russia, his illiteracy, his stupidity, why wouldn't it make the headlines within a week after Oswald was dead? Why wasn't this an important part of the Warren Commission? How did Marina Oswald just get asked about it and nobody else knew about it and she didn't know where this diary was? Which residence did it come from? Which police officers found it? Let them say it under oath about it, because this involves the President of the United States using this diary. When was that diary found? How soon after Oswald was dead was the diary found? Why didn't the original diary go back to Washington, D.C.? Where is it now? Where is the diary that Life used, that Marina was asked about, that the Warren report mentions, that the dates were mixed up on it, the evidence was mixed up, as if Oswald would mix up his own diary? Where is it now? It can be fingerprinted. The microfilm copies of it were fingerprinted and led back to the Dallas officials. Why take fingerprints of Xerox copies? We know who handled the film, but where is that diary now? Let's lay it out on the table and see what typewriter used it. You have the equipment now to go back and find out who wrote it. And what proof, through ink and handwriting and prints, that Oswald ever saw that diary? Let's take the ink on that. Let's take the handwriting, the age of the paper, and see if Oswald really ever wrote that diary. Because if he didn't write that diary, then the country's in as bad shape as saying that he shot from the Mannlicher Carcano. There, see if there's one fingerprint of Lee Harvey Oswald on there. The answer that J. Edgar Hoover gives to the chief counsel, which is good enough for the counsel, is simply that they fingerprinted the Xerox copy of the diary. Marina Oswald, under testimony, only saw a photograph of it, and this is important. Why is that important? Because Dallas to Watergate is a link that is so tight and gets tighter every day in books and articles that there's no way of stopping the gushing of information that various researchers have put together. But you know, a Mr. Lambert worked for Life magazine, and he didn't have a security clearance at all. And he was taken by E. Howard Hunt, first to Mullen Associates and over to the White House. And Mr. Lambert liked to work with E. Howard Hunt in I think it was Argosy magazine. He described Hunt as a man who moves so far ahead of history that he ends up making it. That's what Mr. Lambert said from Life magazine. And Gerald Ford, in the same ilk, makes history. He rewrites history, such as the portrait of the assassin, to keep history at his own level of lies and deceits. Now, you know that Mr. Lambert was called by Life magazine, from Life magazine, E. Howard Hunt, to see those forgeries that were taken. They were actually genuine State Department files. They were secret. Mr. Lambert didn't have top secret security clearance. And E. Howard Hunt gave him these leaks that John Kennedy was responsible for the murder of Diem. Now, E. Howard Hunt worked with James McCord of the CIA and Mr. Conine and Mr. Cushman in these clandestine operations. And Colonel Lansdale, it was Colonel Lansdale who said JFK ordered the murder of Castro. This team has worked together for many, many years in the CIA, and when Watergate came, there was E. Howard Hunt forging documents. He had a razor blade and a typewriter, and he was forging classified State Department files that were top secret to blame John Kennedy for the murder of Diem. So it's important to see if this kind of ink and typewriter and mentality created this fictitious diary after Oswald was dead that was not familiar to his wife or any person, and only provided the excuse for a Gerald Ford to come along and create the story of the deranged Oswald based upon this diary. We're going a full cycle now with Gerald Ford, who was a House member of the House of Representatives, writing American history according to the CIA records. 11 years ago, he was doing this, and now his whole team is suspect. Richard Nixon, Leon Jaworski, Arlene Specter, Frank Sturgis, Albert Jenner, E. Howard Hunt, David Belin, Burke Marshall, the whole JFK cover-up crowd are all active like little bees in a hornet's nest in Washington, D.C., trying to put the lid on all these things. And Gerald Ford, a member of the secret team, is passing the buck on the assassination investigations. He moved from domestic operations, which was what the Rockefeller Committee was to look into, to foreign assassinations, hoping as long as they can to break the shock first of foreign operations, then run out of time and money, and avoid the investigation of domestic political assassinations. Now, Gerald Ford, as a member of the infamous Warren Commission, had a lot of power. Charles McCabe in the San Francisco Chronicle last week had an article on who runs America, and he referred to the media, that the influential people are the ones that control the media, that we're victims. And this goes back to CBS and Gerald Ford and his control of the media. And I've referred on these shows before to the minutes I have of the Warren Commission at December the 6th, 1964. And the problem came up, how should we handle the press while we're writing the Warren Report? And Gerald Ford said, we can't spend a lot of time at the end of each meeting deciding what we're going to say to the press. And a Congressman, Richard Russell, said, we can't operate in a vacuum. People won't stand for it. So Ford said, well, this is a practical problem, but I can handle the AP and UP, the Associated Press and the United Press Network people. It's only the local newspaper people that'll want a personal story. You know how the local people are. Well, the local yokels don't get much news, but the Associated Press, United Press, was under the control of Gerald Ford, member of the Warren Commission, 11 years ago. He had that much control. At their April 30th meeting, there was a question about what to do with Mark Lane, who was exposing various conspiracies in Dallas, and Thomas Buchanan, who was writing a book on the JFK assassination. And Chairman Warren, Earl Warren, said there are rumors and articles such as Buchanan and Mark Lane that are being written. So what I suggest we do, this is Earl Warren saying, we call down the president of the Associated Press and the president of the United Press, and we have them examine their reports and their files, and we have enough men overseas, he says, with these two gentlemen, the two presidents of the Associated Press and United Press, and men overseas, they have the means at hand to get at these rumors and allay the fears of the rumors. And John J. McCloy said, there's a deep-seated feeling, there's a deep conspiracy here, and elements of suppression are involved. And Senator Cooper changes the subject and says, what about George de Morenschild? That was Lee Harvey Oswald's CIA contact in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So the way they handled the researchers like Mark Lane and Buchanan were to call in the Associated Press, United Press, the presidents, and say, put the fears of rumor to death, stop this now, and Oswald was the lone assassin and nothing else will do. And that's exactly what they did. But in order to keep the lone assassin theory going, Gerald Ford was the chosen historian. And next week, I'm going to go into the second part series on Gerald Ford and the control of not only the Associated Press and the United Press, but CBS, The Big Eye, Simon & Schuster, that published his book. Mr. Stiles was the consultant with the book who helped him write this book. And Mr. Volney Morin is the West Coast lawyer getting ready for this great movie on Gerald Ford's book. They were students together. Ford and Stiles and Morin were students in the University of Michigan. And they're arranging the contract with MGM for a 4 or 6 hour show. And I hope through enough letters and protests, maybe we can stop. I'm hopefully counting on you to write letters to CBS and put some kind of pressure on them that will disprove every lie they tell about Gerald Ford's book, that history will prove that they once again are part of this massive cover-up. Well, next week I'm going into more specific facts about the portrait of the assassin, the book by Gerald Ford. But the Oswald diary is as important as the Italian Mannlicher Carcano, and I hope you write letters, pursue this, and let's find the original diary, fingerprint it, and find the links from Dallas to Watergate in that alone. And we'd blow the whole story of Gerald Ford's book, which is one falsification from one end to the other. Well, that's it for this week. I'll see you next week, and take care of yourselves till Dialogue Conspiracy next week.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB-FM in Carmel, California.